The headlines: Israel refusing to release a Palestinian hunger striker at imminent risk of death. The World Health Organization warns over half of Yemenis are struggling to put food on the table. China's president warning his American counterpart that the U.S. support for Taiwan's independence is like, quote, playing with fire. Thanks for joining us. Israel's top court has dismissed an appeal for the immediate release of a hunger-striking Palestinian prisoner who is at imminent risk of death. Now, this is the fourth time that the Israeli Supreme Court has rejected a petition submitted for the release of Fayyad Fasfus. Palestinian Commission for Prisoners says the rejection shows the Israeli officials' indifference and deliberate criminal disregard for the life of an inmate. 34-year-old Fasfus has been on a hunger strike for 125 days in protest at his indefinite detention without charge or trial. Four other Palestinians are also refusing food for months over their so-called administrative detention. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has also expressed support for the detainees and calling for urgent international action to save their lives. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil has been following the latest developments on these Palestinian hunger strikers. She says Israel refuses to heed to their demands for the fear that it would set a precedent for other prisoners and then encourage them for more strike actions.
The Israeli regime rejects to deal with his legal demands because they don't want more Palestinians, especially administrative detainees, to start another hunger strikes and to, in according to them, these hunger strikes will be pressurizing the Israeli regime to accept their demands and end their illegal detention. So the Israeli authorities refuse to deal with the hunger strikers' demands unless they are literally on verge of death. And this is what happened with Miqdad al-Qawasmi last Thursday, and this is what's going on now with Fayyad Fasfus. Those Palestinian prisoners, of course, they are administrative detainees, but they are in different Israeli jails. We are speaking about over 20 Israeli jails across the occupied territories. Mm-hmm. The administrative detainees are from all the Palestinian cities because administrative detention gives the Israeli regime a green light according to their laws to keep Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial. Their lawyers and they themselves do not know what they have done in order to be arrested.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have shot dead a young Palestinian man. Palestinian officials say that he was killed in an armed confrontation. The Palestinian, identified as Saddam Hussein Bani Odeh, got wounded while resisting arrest by Israeli troops in the city of Tubas hours ago. But the 26-year-old died of his injuries later in the hospital. Israeli forces launched a campaign of raids in the area at dawn, triggering the clashes. During the operation, they took away an unknown number of people for taking part in demonstrations against the Israeli occupation. The World Health Organization has voiced concern about the dire humanitarian situation in Yemen, warning that 75% of children there suffer from acute malnutrition. The WHO also said that over 16 million Yemenis are facing food insecurity. That's more than half of the country's total population. Previously, the UN Security Council warned about the increasing risk of severe famine in Yemen, exacerbated by the poor economic situation. Yemen has been mired in a crisis since a Saudi-led coalition launched a devastating war on the country in 2015. Around 80% of the country's population is now in need of humanitarian assistance. Political commentator Eric Wahlberg says the condition of Yemenis would improve once the U.S. stops funding and arms sales to the Saudi-led coalition.
It's terrible, and it could be ended immediately if the U.S., if Biden would just stand by his election promise to stop funding the Saudis. But as with many of his promises, he has backtracked and not fulfilled them. So this is another one where he's gone ahead and proposed further funding of Saudi aircraft, and Ilhan Omar, the congresswoman, has put forward a motion to stop funding the Saudi war machine. This is the same motion that went that was three times vetoed by Trump. Biden makes these futile gestures without doing any real policy. So I don't know if perhaps there will be this move on the part of Congress to stop the funding. Maybe that will end the U.S. funding. That is the only way you're going to get the Saudis to back down, if they finally see that they aren't getting their arms as they wanted before.
Syria is holding another international conference in order to facilitate the return home of more Syrians displaced by the war in recent years. We have talked to our correspondent Mohammed Ali, who is at the event's venue in Damascus. He explains that Syria's ongoing economic recovery is likely to encourage a large number of refugees to return to their country.
This is the second, perhaps, version of the International Conference for Refugees Return in Syria. The first one happened last year. Today, it's a very important conference. It's being organized with efforts from Syria and Russia, primarily over here. And we have witnessed the presence of a high-ranking, huge Russian delegation, officials from various ministries. For 2 days, officials from both countries will be discussing in separate rooms ways and means to enhance the and facilitate the return of Syrian refugees to their homeland. UN representatives, UN resident coordinator in Syria will be also here speaking about the issue of refugees. It's a very important conference when we speak about the timing over here. You need to ask analysts and all of the people attending over, because now we know that Syria started recovering from war. Syria started restoring its relations, or the Arab world has started restoring relations with Syria. Economically speaking, the situation seems to be starting to get better, and this is definitely an encouragement for refugees to return back. What they will be discussing here over here today is reconstruction, the health system, and all kinds of facilitations that encourage Syrians to return back to their home and participate in the reconstruction process.
Taiwan in focus, as U.S. President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping conclude their first face-to-face virtual summit. In a conversation lasting more than 3 hours, the two leaders traded warnings on the future of Taiwan. Biden made a promise of remaining committed to the One China policy that confirms Beijing's sovereignty over Taipei, but also opposing any unilateral move against peace and stability on the island. China's Xi also had some tough words for Biden, likening Washington's support for Taiwan's independence to playing with fire. But in general, the two leaders called for further bilateral cooperation and communication.
A sound Chinese-American relationship is required for advancing our two countries' respective development and for safeguarding a peaceful and stable international environment, including finding effective responses to global challenges such as climate change and the COVID pandemic. China and the United States should respect each other, coexist in peace, and pursue win-win cooperation.
Biden also said Beijing and Washington have a responsibility to avoid conflict in their competitions. They brought up a number of other issues, including trade, human rights, global energy supplies, and the coronavirus pandemic. They also exchanged views on Afghanistan, Iran, and North Korea. The relationship between the world's two biggest economies has been rocky over the past few years. Belarus does not want confrontation. This is what President Alexander Lukashenko has said in the wake of new sanctions by the European Union over a spiraling migrant crisis. Lukashenko says the issue of migrants stranded at the Belarus-Poland border should not lead to clashes with the EU. The president says that he will call German Chancellor Angela Merkel for a second time to further discuss a proposal that he has put forward to end the crisis. The EU has accused Belarus of orchestrating the crisis and using migrants to get concessions from the bloc, retaliation for sanctions. Minsk has dismissed the accusation as absurd. Thousands of migrants, mostly from the Middle East and Asia, are massed at the EU's external border in Belarus in freezing cold. Poland and Lithuania are refusing to let them cross. At least 8 of them have died. The UK government has raised the country's terror alert level from substantial to severe following a car explosion in the northwest city of Liverpool on the weekend. The announcement came after police declared the fatal explosion a terror incident. Syed Purisa has more from Liverpool.
A weekend terror incident in Liverpool, UK. One man killed, one injured, and 4 aged between 20 and 29 arrested under the controversial counter-terrorism law. The mood among some, one of shock and disbelief.
Honestly, shock. You know, I couldn't believe it. I've never been around anything like this in my life. I moved up here just for uni, so to have something happen like this, you know, right next to my accommodation is very scary.
Police say the passenger, 32-year-old Imad Al-Suwaylmin, carried a homemade explosive device into the taxi. The driver, David Perry, who locked the suspect in the car to prevent a worse situation, escaped with minor injuries. The timing has had everyone thinking. Just 2 minutes before Remembrance Sunday, when the entire country remembers Britons killed in wars. In Monday, the government raised the terror threat level from substantial to severe, warning residents to be vigilant.
The police have now confirmed that this is being treated as a terrorist attack, and while the investigation continues at pace, you will understand that I can't comment on the details of the case or its motivation, but it is a stark reminder of the need for us all to remain utterly vigilant.
There are still 3 police cordons in the city, one here at the Women's Hospital, the site of the explosion, and the 2 major streets elsewhere. Police are still investigating to establish the circumstances of what happened. Police are still searching 2 addresses for more clues into the motivation behind the incident. Saeed Purisa, Liverpool.
Iran's envoy, or special envoy for Afghanistan, is visiting the country for talks with the Taliban government on mutual and regional issues. Leading a high-ranking delegation, the envoy is expected to discuss a wide range of issues, including the formation of an inclusive government in the country. Rahmatullah Baghwan has more.
Iran's envoy for Afghanistan, Hassan Kazemi Qumi, has arrived in Kabul for talks on mutual and regional issues. This is the first time that a high-ranking Iranian delegation is visiting Afghanistan since the takeover of the country by the Taliban in August. In an address to reporters upon his arrival in Kabul airport, the Iranian envoy said he would meet senior Taliban officials, adding that security and economic issues would top the agenda. He stressed that 2 neighboring countries need to expand their ties in all areas.
Afghanistan has been destroyed by invaders over the past decades. Now it's time to rebuild the country. We will help our Afghan brothers rebuild their country. A secure Afghanistan can contribute to regional stability. Afghanistan and Iran should have safe borders and expand their economic ties amid U.S. sanctions. We also need to cooperate in the fight against terrorism, as our enemies are conducting proxy wars after their repeated defeats in the region.
On the other hand, the Taliban have voiced their interest in the expansion of ties with Iran. They vow to continue their talks with the aim of increasing mutual cooperation.
Iran's move to send its special envoy means that the country is seeking to establish normal relations with us and increase the level of cooperation between the 2 sides. We have many things in common, particularly when it comes to border security and economic exchanges, so we have to continue our talks.
Tehran has stressed the necessity to establish an inclusive government in Afghanistan, representing all sections of Afghan society. Iran has repeatedly condemned any form of terrorism in Afghanistan and expressed its deep concerns over the fate of Afghan civilians, particularly following the recent terrorist attacks which left hundreds of Shia Afghans dead or wounded. Rahmatullah Baghwan, Kabul.
Another incident of violence against religious minorities in India, this time the home of a former foreign minister, Salman Khurshid, becoming the target of an attack by Hindu militants. Police say that a mob of around 20 people from a hardline local Hindu group gathered outside of Khurshid's house in the state of Uttarakhand on Tuesday, shouting slogans, breaking windows, and ransacking the place. They even set fire to the door of his home. He was not at home during the time of the attack. Khurshid, who is a Muslim, published a book last month in which he's compared Hindu nationalism under Prime Minister Narendra Modi to extremist Daesh terrorists. Activists say violence has been on the rise against religious minorities under Modi, but Modi's government denies that. Last month, a mob of around 200 people attacked a Christian church in the same state. Myanmar's ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi is now facing new charges from the military leadership. She's being accused of fraud and lawless actions during the 2020 general elections. Suu Kyi is already facing several other charges, including illegally importing walkie-talkies, sedition, and corruption. Her party, the National League for Democracy, won the elections last year, but she was ousted from power in a military coup in February. The junta claimed that there were voter irregularities in the polls. She's been in detention ever since. Over 1,200 people have been killed in protests during this time. It's not known when Suu Kyi's new trial will get underway. Heavy rains and flash floods battered British Columbia and Western Canada, forcing thousands of people in the area to evacuate. Rainfall amounting to about 200 millimeters in some areas. The downfall has washed bridges, compromised wastewater treatment in the town of Merritt, northeast of Vancouver. In the town of Agassiz, the flooding has caused mudslides, trapping many in their cars for hours. Some 7,000 people are now away from their homes, trying to stay safe. Emergency centers are helping those impacted by the rainfall. There are concerns that the downpour may cause widespread power outages. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, as a reminder, we talked about Imam Khomeini's recommendations to the seminaries and religious scholars of ulama, which were issued in his faithful message and also in his testament. In today's program, we're going to touch upon Imam's advice to the executive branch of the government, especially the foreign ministry and Iranian diplomats. Stay with us for more. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to stress that if the executive branch of the government is not reformed, no remarkable result would be gained for the nation, even if there were good laws. He wrote in his testament, "Among the affairs that need to be reformed, purified, and cared for is the executive branch of the government. Sometimes progressive and useful laws may be passed in the parliament, and the Guardian Council may approve it, and the relevant minister may proclaim it. But it may go to unrighteous executors, so that they would annul it, and contrary to the rules, or with the bureaucracies and twisting that they have got used to, or intentionally, they act in a way to make people worried, to gradually cause a row." Imam Khomeini considered honest bond with people and rendering services to them, especially to the less well-off and deprived classes, as an undeniable necessity of the Islamic Republic. He used to emphasize that neglecting the principle is religiously forbidden and would incur divine wrath. The Imam wrote, "The budget from which you and the employees of the ministries are paid from belongs to the nation. You should be the servants of the nation, especially the oppressed. And you should know that causing trouble for people and acting opposite to their duty is haram or religiously forbidden, and God forbid would sometimes incur divine wrath. All of you need the nation's support. It was with the people's support, particularly the less well-off and the deprived classes, that victory was achieved, and the hand of the oppressive kingdom was cut off from the country and its reserves. And if one day you are deprived of their support, you will be put aside, and, like the oppressive royal regime, oppressors would occupy the posts instead of you. In view of this tangible reality, you must try to draw the people's attention and refrain from un-Islamic and inhumane behavior." Khomeini, may God bless his soul, said in a famous speech to cabinet ministers and the government, he said, "Serve this nation which has cut off the treacherous hands and has put its trust in you. As long as you are such, the nation will back you, and as long as the nation accompanies you, no harm will occur to you and the country." The Imam writes to the foreign ministry and diplomats, "I recommend the foreign minister in this era and the next era to be heedful that your responsibility is very much either in the reformation and development of the ministry and embassies or the foreign ministry, safeguarding the independence of this country and the interests of this country, and good relations with governments which don't intend to meddle in our country's affairs. And seriously refrain from anything that is suspicious of dependence with all of its dimensions. And know that dependence in some affairs, although it may have a deceptive appearance or interest and use for the time being, however, it would draw the country to destruction." Imam Khomeini believed that an important step towards independence of the foreign ministry is to reinforce bonds with Islamic countries, and asked the diplomatic missions to embark on awakening the Islamic countries and inviting Muslim nations to unity and solidarity. The Imam wrote, "I recommend to the nations of Islamic countries not to expect anyone from abroad to help you in reaching the goal which is Islam and executing Islamic laws and rules. You yourselves should rise up for this vital affair, which will materialize freedom and independence. and the great religious scholars and respectful preachers of Islamic countries should invite governments to get rid of dependence on big foreign powers and to rely on their own abilities. In this way, they will embrace victory, and they should invite nations to unity and refrain from racism, which is opposite to the rule of Islam, and shake hands of brotherhood with their brethren in faith in any country and with any race, as the great Islam has called on them as brothers. And if one day this brotherhood in faith materializes with the efforts of governments and nations and the help of Almighty God, you will see that Muslims will form the greatest power on earth. Imam Khomeini also warns staff of the foreign ministry by saying, "Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, I have issued recommendations to foreign ministers about development of embassies, which should be compatible with Islamic Republic. Yet, some of them either didn't want to or failed to take any positive action."
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's called the Belarus-Poland migrant crisis, and the EU is faulting Belarus for it. It has decided to widen Belarus sanctions as the row intensifies. But is the EU hyping the crisis against Belarus due to its disagreement with the contested presidential election, which saw Lukashenko regain his presidency? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether this migrant crisis has its roots at military action that EU countries, along with the U.S., have taken in different parts of the world, especially in West Asia. First, let's get the latest on this. Jerome Hughes is our correspondent joining us from Brussels. Jerome, welcome. So what is the latest that we have on this? We know that the sanctions were extended by the EU. Tell us about that and, of course, the reaction coming from Belarus, if there was any at this point.
That's right, Kaveh. Well, the situation seems to be escalating. There's no doubt about that. I've just been reading an article in one of the so-called mainstream media outlets, the New York Times, and it talks about the fact that the EU has spent billions of euro. This is something we've been saying on Press TV for many years now. The EU is sending billions of euro to countries, say, for example, in Africa, most notably Libya, and also outside of Africa, say, Turkey, to prevent refugees from coming here. So what we're hearing is, the analysts I've been speaking to, they say this smacks of hypocrisy, that we have a situation whereby the EU is criticizing Belarus, but at the same time, look at aid agencies like Oxfam, they describe it as Fortress Europe, in other words, Fortress EU. The EU is doing all in its power to prevent refugees from coming here. And whether you describe this, as morally reprehensible or, the ethics are all wrong, actually, under international law, the EU has an obligation because rich countries have to take in those seeking asylum. But the EU has a policy of pushing back, repelling refugees. You see 15,000 troops in Poland who are trying to prevent refugees from coming here. And so there is a lot of hypocrisy. And also, it has to be pointed out that we have a situation whereby the government in Minsk, let's face it, is friendly with the government in Moscow. And you have this constant provocation. You talked about sanctions, more sanctions on Belarus. And look at what the EU lawmakers have been saying during the debates last week in the European Parliament. Many of them, not the majority, but a sizable number, have been saying that sanctions don't work. Look at the situation in Moscow, in Russia. Look at the situation in Iran, South African countries, South American countries, I should say, and African countries. Sanctions don't work. It hasn't pushed back Iran. It hasn't pushed back Russia. that they are, these countries are thriving in their own way. They have other allies in other parts of the world, like China. And so these sanctions against Belarus, certainly, according to the people I've been speaking to, the EU lawmakers, the analysts, they won't work either. You know, constantly we hear Joseph Borrell, the EU foreign policy chief, he talks about Moscow or Russia having the same size economy as California. And it's this constant, apart from the sanctions, it's this constant putting down these world powers. And it doesn't seem to work. Russia put the first man in space. Until Elon Musk came along, Russia, the only way the United States could get to the International Space Station was using Russian rockets. Two-thirds of the energy being used in the EU comes from Russia, and most of it passes through Belarus. So to try and belittle Russia and, you know, you could say its friendly neighbor Belarus and put in these sanctions, the reality is they just don't seem to work.
Thank you for that. We appreciate that. That's Jerome Hughes from Brussels with the latest on that. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have historian, political analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos joining us from London. Also joining us is senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samioli, who joins us from Budapest.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. And George Samioli, I'm going to start with you. Quickly, if you can, give us the short version of what you see as transpiring there on the Poland-Belarus border, how you view this migrant crisis, and whether it's being politicized.
Well, unfortunately, it is indeed being politicized. I mean, the European Union is playing quite a slimy game here. I mean, they really don't care too much about these migrants who are already now freezing in this icy winter temperatures. They want to score political points against Belarus, and of course they're trying to blame Russia for this, and Russia of course has nothing whatever to do with this. Look, as I think your correspondent pointed out, the EU has had these problems before. Erdogan in Turkey has something like 3-4 million refugees that he repeatedly threatens to unleash on the EU, and Germany regularly pays him off in order to stop him doing so. There are migrants who are, that are coming from North Africa, you know, when they're in the Mediterranean, they're shipped off to Italy. We have migrants crossing the English Channel, again, you know, whenever they're apprehended on the English Channel, the British ship them to safety. So what's so special about this case? Why is it that the EU is unable to do anything at all to help? Well, what's so special is they're coming from Belarus, and he wants to score points against Belarus. There's a very simple solution to this, which is pick up a phone, call Lukashenko, and ask him what is his price. I'm pretty sure his price is a lot lower than Erdogan's price. Belarus is a tiny country compared to Turkey, and all he probably wants is sanctions being lifted off Minsk, but the EU, for ideological reasons, isn't prepared to pay that price.
What was Turkey's price, by the way? Do you know?
I think it's something like 3-4 billion euros.
Uh-huh. Okay, so Marcus Papadopoulos, let me review with you this EU accusation and see what you think. Where the EU has accused Alexander Lukashenko, the Belarusian president, orchestrating the influx of migrants to pressure it to back down over sanctions slapped on the government. Now, Belarus has dismissed that as being absurd. How do you view it?
The tension on the Polish-Belarusian border is not in itself about migrants. After all, America, Britain, the European Union, and NATO had no qualms about allowing well over 1 million migrants to enter Europe as a result of Britain, America, NATO, and the EU having destabilized both Libya and Syria through having supported terrorists in both countries. No. What we see at the Polish-Belarusian border is geostrategic politics in action, and specifically, Russia is the target. Firstly, America and Britain do not wish the union state of Russia and Belarus, let us remember, Belarus is the historical name of Belarus, they do not want the union state of Russia and Belarus to materialize, whereby Belarus will reunify with Russia. Why? Because in the event of the union state of Russia and Belarus coming into being, Russian national security in Eastern Europe will receive a tremendous boost. Secondly, America and Britain are trying to foment civil unrest in Belarus in the hope that this will assist them in their quest to initiate a coup in Belarus aimed to bring down President Alexander Lukashenko, to wrestle Belarus out of Moscow's orbit and into the West's sphere of influence. And thirdly, NATO, which of course is directed by Washington and London, is looking for a pretext to increase NATO's presence in Eastern Europe, in the Baltic, and of course in the Black Sea region, which of course is an anti-Russia motivation. And as a result of the last few days, what we now see is NATO having its pretext to go ahead in increasing its soldiery and weaponry along the Russian border. As I said at the beginning, this situation on the Polish-Belarusian border has nothing to do with migrants. After all, there are only a few thousand migrants at the Belarusian, the Polish-Belarusian border, and yet the Americans, the British, the EU, and NATO had no qualms about allowing well over 1 million migrants into Europe a few years ago.
Right. Well, let's see here. First of all, George Samioli, do you agree with the assessment they're made, the analysis they're made by Marcus Papadopoulos?
I do. I think that there is clearly a strategic agenda here. It's been of long standing, which is to topple the government of Lukashenko in Belarus and thereby weaken Russia substantially. Let's keep in mind that the regime change that the Western powers engineered in Ukraine in February of 2014 was a strategic blow to Russia. There's no question. I mean, that having bad relations with a country that is basically kind of a brother nation that is Ukraine was a huge blow to Russia, and losing Belarus would indeed be something that would be strategically catastrophic. And that is why I believe that the EU and the United Kingdom and NATO want to continue to aggravate this crisis at the border and make this into this giant propaganda exercise in demonizing both Russia and Belarus. I mean, how is Russia in any way involved in this? And yet, if you listen to, or rather read the article written by UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss over the weekend, somehow it is all Russia's fault because Russia was supposed to have leaned on Lukashenko and told him what to do, which kind of undermines the whole idea that, you know, Belarus and Russia are kind of two separate states. So I think that there's no question that that is the agenda. And of course, as Marcus points out, I mean, we're only talking about a few thousand. So it is fascinating to see why this sudden hysteria about a few thousand when, in 2015, a million migrants were absorbed by the EU. And again, why focus there rather than on what's going on, say, in the English Channel? Are they coming from Belarus? Are the migrants that are coming from North Africa and going to Italy, are they coming from Belarus? So this is all a part of the kind of engineering this hostile alliance against Russia.
Okay, so we have what has been described by you, Marcus Papadopoulos, which the main target appears to be Russia, as you said. But looking at Moscow's reaction is a bit of an eye-opener, because from what we understand, Moscow sent nuclear-capable bombers to patrol the Belarusian skies and nations bordering Belarus. As a result, have voiced alarm because of that. How do you view Russia's reaction militarily here in terms of sending these bombers?
Belarus and the Russian Federation, on paper, are two separate countries. The truth of the matter, however, is that Belarus is de facto a part of the Russian Federation. The Belarusian armed forces are de facto a part of the Western Military District of the Russian Federation. However, whilst the chances of a Western coup succeeding in Belarus are negligible, Russia cannot take any chances whatsoever. That is why Russia has learned from its mistakes it made regarding Ukraine at the end of 2013 and the beginning of 2014, when the Kremlin was very, very slow to react to what was clearly a Western orchestrated coup in the making. So in regard to Belarus, that is why the Kremlin has dispatched nuclear bombers to safeguard the borders of Belarus and effectively the borders of the Union State of Russia and Belarus. That is also why the Kremlin has dispatched Russian paratroopers to safeguard the border of Belarus, which of course is also the border of the Union State of Russia and Belarus. In hypothetically speaking, if a Western coup was to succeed in Belarus and Belarus was to be brought into the West's sphere of influence, that would be a catastrophic setback for Russian national security, because what it would mean is that the entire frontier of the Russian Federation in the West, from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, would be enclosed with countries which are in the West's sphere of influence. And we know already that Britain has sent soldiers to Poland to, officially speaking, advise the Polish government on how to secure its border. My own personal view is those British soldiers should actually be in Dover, actually safeguarding Britain's border against illegal migration across the English Channel. And also, the British have said that they have 600 paratroopers and SAS soldiers ready to go to Poland if the situation deteriorates on the Belarusian-Polish border.
Okay.
So that is why Russia is taking the situation so very seriously, but also Russia is compelled to because of the Union State of Russia and Belarus, which, I should add, will materialize sooner rather than later.
Okay, well, we do need to talk about the humanitarian aspect of this, George Zamiali, and the hypocrisy that's involved. At the top of the broadcast or the program, we had our correspondent talk about how what EU says and does is hypocritical, because it spends billions to stop these refugees from coming to the EU countries, even though as a rich nation they need to take in some refugees. We can have your reaction on that issue, and also how, for example, the U.S. Stops migrants crossing the border from, for example, Mexico, never mind the harsh treatment that these migrants receive. So are we sensing here a sense of hypocrisy from the EU and the US also?
Well, yes. It is kind of interesting that the accusations against Belarus that, you know, Belarus is to blame for the migrant flow. Well, no one in the United States would ever, at least no respectable person in the United States would try to do that in Mexico. They say, well, in Mexico is to blame for the migrant flow that's quite substantial into the United States. But in terms of the humanitarianism, that's absolutely right. I mean, we have these migrants now sleeping out in the cold. This is now getting, it's middle of November. It is very, very cold. And why is this happening? Well, it's happening because the EU, NATO, the United Kingdom, and the United States want to use this as a massive propaganda campaign against Russia and Belarus, and therefore to show, hey, these are the people we're up against. So we've got a democracy summit that's scheduled for December the 9th and December the 10th, so it's in about 3 weeks' time. And, you know, what's going to be on the agenda? Well, the agenda will be the terrible people such as Russia and Belarus, because Iran will be included in that. But that is part of the ideological mobilization that NATO is continuing to engage in. So they really don't care about the plight of these migrants. I think they're quite happy to have this on the news every night. And then they point to, hey, well, who's to blame? Well, it's these terrible people, Putin and Lukashenko. And, you know, and this is being done, stated explicitly by Western officials, as I say, by the UK Foreign Secretary, who's now, you know, going around mouthing this nonsense day after day.
So let's try to figure out through you, Marcus Papadopoulos, what is going to happen in this situation. One aspect of it, which was interesting, was the fact that the Belarusian President Lukashenko threatened to cut off gas supplies to Europe, and Putin said that he did not approve of that, in so many words. And he said that, I think he said perhaps Lukashenko said that in a fit of anger. Do you see something like that transpiring? I mean, at this point, the EU has leveled sanctions. It may even go further. How do you see it?
No, I do not see gas supplies being cut off whatsoever. After all, as I said moments ago, Belarusia is de facto a part of the Russian Federation, and under no circumstances will the Kremlin allow anything to disrupt the flow of Russian natural gas to Europe. Why? Because in a scenario where the flow of natural gas, Russian natural gas to Europe, is disrupted, the Russian economy would suffer immensely, and would suffer immensely overnight. And let us not forget that the West's sanctions on Russia, which have been in force for coming up to 8 years now, are very severe. And one of the ways that Russia has managed to mitigate the losses it's sustained is by increasing the flow of Russian natural gas to Europe, but also to China. So undoubtedly, Lukashenko made that comment either in a fit of rage or to provoke the West, but under no circumstances will the Russian natural gas be disrupted in its flow to Europe. No. What we will see is, as a result of the tension on the Polish-Belarusian border, we will see NATO's presence increase in Eastern Europe and in the Baltic and in the Black Sea, and consequently we will see Russia and Belarus's initiative to initiate the reunification of the two countries come into play sooner rather than later.
Okay.
And the West has actually inadvertently sped up the integration between Belarusia and Russia, because Moscow and Minsk clearly understand there is a very serious threat imposed to Belarusia by NATO and the European Union. Mm-hmm. And the way that Russia will safeguard its security on its western border and, in fact, increase enormously its security on its western border is by ensuring that Russia and Belarusia reunify. And as I keep on saying, that will happen sooner rather than later.
Do you think that a reunification is going to be the outcome here, George Samueli? Is it even required, given the fact that we know Russia does support Belarus in the form and fashion that it has?
Well, that's it. I think that the unification is has been an ongoing thing, and de facto they are one country, particularly as Belarus is clearly under threat, and the only thing that saves Belarus is that it's that Russia has its back. I mean, you know, obviously there are lots of issues that need to be ironed out before they can become one state, but de facto it is one state, and that's, and therefore anyone who tries anything with Belarus knows that they have Russia to deal with. And Russia has made this very clear, that in any attempt at staging a coup in Minsk will be met with force from Moscow. So, yeah, de facto, it is essentially already one state.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guests, historian, political analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos from London. Thank you for your comments. And senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, spoke to us from Budapest, and we had our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, spoke to us from Brussels. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Watawe and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, my dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Salaam Alaikum, thank you all very much for joining us. This is a special program on the occasion of the demise or the martyrdom of Lady Fatima Masuma, peace be upon her, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that, whether it's a demise or a martyrdom later on in the program, inshallah. But before that, I would like to introduce to you the honorable guest of our program, my favorite guest, Dr. Abbas Ali Shamali, my beloved father. Salaamu Alaikum and thank you for joining us.
Alaikum Assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. I need to express my salams and greetings to all brothers and sisters who are listening to this program. First of all, we need to show our sadness and condolences for the occasion of martyrdom of Lady Fatima Masuma Salamullah ta'ala alayha, whom we are dwelling in her shrine nowadays for years, taking benefits.
Thank you very much. For our dear audience who are not familiar with Dr. Shamali, I would like to give you a very brief introduction. Dr. Shamali has studied in the Islamic Seminary in Qom for over 30 years. He's been teaching here for the past 20 years. He has a PhD in Culture and Values in Education from McGill University, Canada. And at the moment, he's a staff member of Al-Mustafa International University. So, Dr. Shamali, let's start with the very name of Masuma, which means the infallible. And as I know, this is the only non-infallible who has been given this title, Masuma, or infallible, by an imam who is himself an infallible. So this says something about her status. Can you elaborate a little bit on that, please?
Actually, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi emphasized to name all his daughters as Fatima.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the historical documents, he came with four Fatima, Fatimiyat. Fatima al Kubra, who is Fatima Ma'suma, Lady Ma'suma in Qom. Fatima Sughra in Azerbaijan. Fatima Wusta in northern part of Iran. And Fatima Ukhra in Isfahan. So he had four. Of course, he may had more, but we have documents about four Fatima. Among them, Lady Ma'suma was very outstanding because of her spiritual, intellectual, and divine characteristics she enjoyed. The best characteristics of Fatima Ma'suma, as you mentioned, was Ma'suma, infallible, sinlessness. The one who enjoys sinlessness. And this title was given, gifted to her by her brother Imam Ali and Musa al-Ridha salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, because of her dedication and commitment, total dedication and commitment to the laws and regulations, to worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and also to defense with regard to the belief system of Shia ideas and belief system.
Right. So moving on to the next part and our next question, we know that Lady Fatima Ma'suma and Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha, our eighth imam, our eighth infallible imam, are brother and sister. They are actually from one mother, so they are direct or whole brother and sister. And it's we have in the narrations, if I'm not wrong, from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, that whoever visits my aunt in Qom is like he has visited me. So this says a lot. I mean, like when an infallible imam not only gives, not only that she gets a title of Ma'suma, the infallible, by an infallible imam, but that she is said to, that her ziyara is said to have the same reward or thawab as visiting an infallible imam. So a little bit on that, please.
You mentioned, the only title of Ma'suma is given to Fatima Ma'suma, neither to Zainab Kubra, neither to Khadija, neither to any other. But Lady Fatima Ma'suma, the daughter of Musa ibn Ja'far salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi.
Right.
But the narration that you mentioned with regard from Imam Sadiq, it's not from Imam Sadiq.
Mm.
It's from Imam Ali al-Ridha, mm-hmm. salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi.
From her brother again.
Man zara Ma'suma biqom keman zara. Those who visit Fatima Ma'suma in Qom exactly resembles to visiting my shrine in Tus. So it shows the high status of Fatima Ma'suma before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because when infallible imam provides such a statement, it shows that he is providing us a fact. And this is because of her special status before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's amazing that intercession of all Shia is gifted to Lady Fatima Ma'suma salawatullahi wa salamu alayha from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in according to a riwayah from Imam Sadiq.
Mm-hmm.
And this is because of her dedication, her knowledge, her support, and her defense with regard to the infallible imam, the position of the institution of imamate. It's very important that as well as that reward and thawab, it is said that those who visit the shrine of Fatima Ma'suma is exactly as those who visit the shrine of Imam Ali al-Ridha. Why? Because the same in terms of everything,
mm-hmm.
spirituality, dedication,